Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about how we can keep our Wisconsin lakes healthy. And the author of the book Ripple Effects offers up some solutions. And the author is Ted Ralsey. He writes the newspaper column, The Lake Where You Live. He's active in lake advocacy organizations, including the Wisconsin Citizen Lake Monitoring Network. And he's also the author of A Lakeside Companion. He was elected president of the Oneida County Lakes and Rivers Association in 2022. And his book, Ripple Effects, How We're Loving Our Lakes to Death, is a dandy. And I'm looking forward to talking with him about it. I bet you frequent a lake from time to time. Maybe you're part of a lake association. Let us know what's going on with the lakes that you love in your community, perhaps. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's at 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Ted Ralsey, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me on your program, Larry.
I'll tell you what. You know, this book, Ripple Effects, it seems to me as I was reading it, this is kind of a natural extension, progression, what have you, of all of your work over the years.
Yeah, this is a book that I was motivated to write because of what I observed going on in the Northwoods where I live. My first book, A Lakeside Companion, is basically an introduction to lake life and lake science that should be accessible to anyone. This book takes a deeper look at what's actually happening with our lakes, how we're interacting with them, and where we're maybe making some mistakes and where we could be doing better to keep our lakes in good condition and preserve the Northwoods way of life.
Yeah. So we're loving our lakes to death. How is that so?
Well, we enjoy our lakes. We want to enjoy them in our own fashion, and we build our homes, our boathouses, our gazebos, our piers, and we get our boats. And we tend to think, not to think as much as we should about how what we're doing on the land is affecting the water, because those effects can be substantial. It can be affecting the overall health of the lake ecosystem, the fish life, the water quality, the scenic values. So we need to think carefully when we develop our properties about what we're doing. Think beyond ourselves and think of the greater good.
You know, and when you're talking about developing the properties, I enjoyed the sort of history of your own family and its progression on a couple of different lakes.
Yeah, Mike, actually, the first chapter is about my cousin Tom and his family, and they have property on a little lake called McDonald Lake near Eagle River, and we traced I think they're kind of an example of how a lot of Wisconsin families came to love the North Woods, come in as tourists long ago when you're children, and you retain that love that you developed for the lake, and sometime you want to own lake property of your own. And their progression from having just a campsite to now a four-season humble but very nice cabin, it's just a really neat story and typical, I think, of a lot of family stories.
And, of course, and you talk about your own role as a landowner on a lake.
Right. I was enchanted by the Northwoods from having growing up on taking vacations on a lake just into Michigan's Upper Peninsula in some really wild country, very little development on the lake, big woods, and came to just really appreciate the Northwoods experience and always wanted to have property up north, finally was able to make that happen. And so we live here on Birch Lake in Oneida County, and about a 180-acre lake that we enjoy a lot. I'm trying to pass on that love of lakes now to our kids and our grandkids.
Yeah. As you look at it and as you describe in your book, maybe just give us an overview of what people can expect to learn from your book.
I think the main thing is the for one thing, the emotional connection that we all have. I tried to begin each chapter with an individual personal story of how impact of the lakes affects us emotionally, because we all have, a lot of us have really deep connections to our lakes. And I guess fundamentally I'd like people to realize, again, that what we do on the land has a major effect on the water, and that we should, there are certain things that we should do as lake property owners. One of them is to keep our shoreline as natural as possible, because the shoreline habitat is the most biodiverse, the most richest that there is around a lake. And we need to go light on the fertilizers and pesticides, if we use them at all, take good care of our septic systems, make sure that we keep runoff on our property instead of letting it get into the water. Things like that, they're pretty basic things that if everybody did, our lakes would be a lot better off.
Yeah, they sure would indeed. Well, and by the way, you have so many great stories, and there's so many people involved. I mean, how'd you find all these people? Or are these people, I think many of them were just people that you've come in contact with over the years.
Yeah, that's true. And I encounter a lot of people through my work with lake associations. I give presentations to associations around the state, and actually over in Minnesota and Michigan as well. So I meet people that way. I do quite a bit of reading. My first book, Lakeside Companion, was based on a lot of self-study, and I met a lot of people that way. And then there's just looking around various topics of interest on the internet and finding people, scientists, university people, lake association people who are doing good and important work.
Marilyn emailed us and asked you to talk about the effects of wake boats, and it turns out I was going to ask that same question, because that's a piece of your book deals with wake boats. And, well, maybe first, you know, people might not even be aware of what a wake boat is.
Well, wake boats are boats that are designed to create a large wake behind them so that people can either ride on a wakeboard pulled by a rope behind the boat and do all kinds of jumps and spins over the waves, or actually stand on a surfboard and actually surf behind the boat without any rope connected to the boat at all. These boats are able to make wakes that are large enough to enable that kind of sport. And there's no denying that those sports would be fun. But it's also no denying that those large wakes have severe impacts.
Yeah. You talked about one story was, you know, the family with the kids and everything along a lake shore, and a wake comes in like a tidal wave almost.
Yeah, the waves hit the shoreline with quite a bit of energy. There's been some studies done, lots of studies, but one in particular on North Lake right here in Wisconsin that was actually conducted in part by my alma mater, which is Carroll University, where they measured the energy of these wakes, and it's a lot different. The wake from a wake boat is a lot different in size and in character than the wake from, let's say, a water ski boat or a pleasure boat runabout.
So what, and it has effects not only on the shoreline, but the ecosystem of the lake itself.
Right. The wake boats, especially in wake surf mode, they're traveling along at about 8 to 11 miles per hour and kind of in a bow-up configuration, so that the propeller, and these boat engines have, they're up to 600 horsepower, some of them. And so there's a tremendous amount of energy coming out of that propeller, and it has a significant downward component to it. And it's been determined that the downwash from that propeller can stir up the sediment on the bottom that contains phosphorus and resuspend that phosphorus, which was actually just lying on the bottom doing nothing. And phosphorus, as we know, is the leading cause of harmful algae blooms in lakes.
Yeah, and you know, I suppose on Lake Michigan, a wake boat on Lake Michigan, if it's out a ways from the shore, that's one thing. But you don't want to stick a wake boat on a 150-acre lake.
Yeah, we'll talk 180 acres. That's my lake, and we sure don't want to see that kind of watercraft on our lake. But yeah, there are movements afoot now to impose some regulations on wake boating and hazardous wakes in general. And the kinds of numbers that get talked about are forbidding enhanced wakes from within 500 or maybe 700 feet from the shoreline to give the wave energy time to dissipate, to limit wake boat operation to water depths of, say, 15, 20 feet deep so that propeller wash can't get all the way to the bottom, and maybe even limiting wake boat operation to lakes of a certain size. One number that's been thrown around is 1,500 acres.
Yeah, that would seem like a minimum, I would think. But so the lake associations and so forth don't really have power to impose those kinds of restrictions now?
No, generally the lake associations don't have any enforcement authority. That would fall to the DNR or to a sheriff's department water patrol if one exists. So largely, and I think an important part of this whole controversy is boater education. I don't think boater education is a solution by itself, and most people that I'm in contact with don't think so either. But it's also a fact that if wake boats operate in the deepest part of the lake and the farthest from shore, then their impacts generally are reduced. And the manufacturers will tell you that wake boats operate the most effectively in deeper water. So if boaters operate responsibly and maybe confine their operation to certain hours of the day, a lot of conflicts can be eliminated.
Yeah. It's this whole, the community, you know, you're in a person may be in a community, a lake community, but just sort of balancing the protection of your lake with the enjoyment of a sport.
Right. You know, there are so many different kinds of uses of lakes, and some conflicts are just about inevitable. Some lakes have what might be called courtesy codes. Generally, you know, common sense. Think about the other person and enjoy your particular sport at appropriate times of day and kind of stay out of each other's way. Everybody gets along.
Ted Ralsei, our guest today, his book is titled Ripple Effects, How We're Loving Our Lakes to Death. You can join in with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Clara Neipert's our producer today, Sarah Hopeful, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Taking a look at our lakes on the program today with our guest, Ted Ralsei, author of Ripple Effects, How We're Loving Our Lakes to Death. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. And let's take a call. Tanya in Stevens Point, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. So I so appreciate this guest for sure. I work in the home, Wisconsin, and I'm a cleaning lady. I take care of vacation homes on the lake. And I get so frustrated with the pesticides and the fertilizers and the overwatering on these lake homes. And, of course, I can't say anything because I'm a cleaning lady. But, boy, if you could come to Rome, just educate some of these vacation home owners over here, it would really help.
Tanya, thanks very much for calling. And Tanya brings up something that you talk about in your book, you know, this sort of the evolution of lakes, lake homes in the state.
Yeah, we used to, if you go back to, say, the 1950s, 1960s, what we had around most of our lakes were little one- and two-bedroom seasonal family cottages. And those are gradually being replaced by much larger lake homes. And the impact on the environment of a lake home versus a little lake cabin is substantial. You create more impervious surfaces when you build a bigger lake home, and you create more runoff down into the water. that increases the incursion of silt and phosphorus into the water. And and I'm not saying that we shouldn't have lake homes. My wife and I bought a vacant lot. We built a lake home. But I think we just need to be responsible as lake home owners, realizing that this larger structure potentially has a larger impact, and take good care of our property, see that we don't impact the lake more than we have to.
Yeah, you might just describe what you've done in terms of, practicing what you preach there, Ted.
Yeah, well, we built a modest house. There's just the two of us, so we don't need a large home. But basically what we've done is we've kept our shoreline just about completely natural. We had to obviously cut down trees to build our house and install our septic system. But between the house and the lake, we left the woods intact. You can barely see our house from the lake. We have what we might call a filtered view of the water. So when we sit on our screen porch, we see the water sparkling between the branches and leaves of the trees. And, we tried to treat the county shoreland zoning ordinances as minimum standards and not do everything that we were allowed to do. Just it's basically about keeping the shoreline natural. And a lot of the people on our piece of shoreline have done similar things, so we're pleased with that.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you mentioned a septic system, and I have some really cool... Well, first, maybe talk about it can be a big source of pollution for lakes, and there's some really interesting work. And one of the things I like about your book a lot is that you do offer up solutions and what's been done by others. And let's take up that whole topic of septic systems.
Yeah, septic systems are the way we treat our wastewater around the lakes. We're not connected to sewers. And if we take good care of our septic systems, they do a good job of treating the wastewater. But on the other hand, if we don't maintain the septic systems and they fail, then they can release pollutants into the environment. The University of Minnesota has a tool that measures the impact of septic systems, and they will tell you that, according to that tool, one failing septic system can release 4 pounds of phosphorus, roughly, into a lake in a given year. And that may not sound like a lot, but there's something called the algae adage that says every 1 pound of phosphorus released into a lake can generate 500 pounds of algae. So if you take 4 pounds of phosphorus, that's 2,000 pounds of algae, 1 ton for one failing septic system. And if you've got multiple failing septic systems around the lake, the amount of phosphorus and the amount of algae growth in the water can be increased significantly.
Yeah, and you cite at least one lake, and I'm sorry, I'm just forgetting the particulars of it right now, where they actually did something about that problem that they were having on the lake. And maybe talk about what approach they took.
Yeah, it's the Otter Tail Lakes Water Management District in Minnesota. They found that their lakes were being impacted by septic systems. They were able to measure pathogens in the water. Water quality, water clarity was declining. And so this goes all the way back to the 1980s. What they did then was they inspected every septic system around those lakes. It's a chain of 5 lakes. At the time, a total of about 1,200 septic systems were inspected. Those that were in poor condition were replaced or repaired. And then they established a maintenance program where everybody on that lake has to maintain their septic system either on their own or by having the water management district do it. And as a result, if you would graph a line water clarity over time, the clarity of the water over the years almost doubled, and largely because the septic systems were replaced and the amount of phosphorus in the water also declined dramatically. So it was a really highly successful project that was executed with help from some federal money. Unfortunately, such money's not really available today, but it was then.
Yeah, it was then. But it just offers a solution to what can be done with the right push.
Right. I like to, somebody once asked the baseball slugger Reggie Jackson, what is the key to success? And he said, don't give me what you've got, give me what it takes. And, you know, sometimes when we work to improve our lakes, we kind of make incremental improvements. But here on the, in the Outer Lake Management District, Water Management District, that's an example of let's do what it really takes to get the job done. And we see, we don't see that maybe as often as we could. There's lots of reasons for that. But
yeah. Ted in Green Bay couldn't stay with us, but wonders why we're filling in the marshes. And he cites the typical, as an example, the west side of the mouth of the Fox River, when marshes do so much to filter out our water.
Yeah, that's not an area that I got into in the book. It's not really my area of expertise, but wetlands really are a critical part of healthy ecosystems. They provide a lot of ecological value. They provide flood control, and it's really important that they be preserved.
Jill sent us an email and wonders, where's the outrage and legislation over all the pesticides and fertilizers used for the lawns on lakefront properties and all properties for that matter, pollinators, wildlife, fish. We obviously can't rely on always on people to do the right thing.
Yeah, one of the things that we see up in this area of the state this time of year is all these little signs that say mosquito police or other kinds of mosquito abatement companies. And these pesticides are a blunt instrument. If you're killing the mosquitoes, you're also killing the butterflies, the caterpillars, other insects. And so that's an issue. And just in general, there's really no need to, when you live up here, to aspire to such a perfect lawn. There's a biologist in Minnesota named Paul Radomski who will tell you that the invasive or the non-native plant species that has done more harm than any other is Kentucky bluegrass, which is the grass that we plant to create our lawns. The reason it's a problem is the Kentucky bluegrass or any lawn grass has very shallow root system, and it allows water to flow right over it into the lake and carry fertilizer, pesticides, phosphorus, and silt with it.
Paul's been a guest on the show more than once, as a matter of fact, to talk about that and other things as well. Andreas in Whitewater emailed, they feel there's a common belief that most Northwoods lake homes are owned by folks from Illinois. Is this true?
Yeah, well, they're owned by people from Illinois. They're owned by people from Minnesota. They're owned by people from Wisconsin. This is a very attractive area to own property, and people who are within driving distance, even from other states, there are probably people from over in Michigan who own property here. So, sure, that's true.
But Minnesota, I know there's a pretty heavy Minnesota influence here as well, as you point out. The story of from one lake property owner about out-of-towners, this kind of comes to mind based on the email, who become unruly when they visit the lake. You share a story from one lake property owner about that. How could we make a lake vacation culture more respectful?
Yeah, that story, that anecdote in the book is about something that we call short-term rentals. They're sometimes called tourist rooming houses, and that's where someone, let's say that I decided that I wanted to rent out my house to other people a few weeks a year to cover my property taxes or whatever. And sometimes these houses get rented out not just to another, you know, wife and husband and two kids, but to a whole group of 10, 12, 15 people for a party house for a weekend. And when that happens, you get a lot of problems with litter, with noise complaints, with fireworks, and everybody's got a boat, so there's more boats on the lake. And so, and also when you're overloading a house like that with 10 to 15 people in a two or three bedroom house, you're probably also overloading the septic system. So there's a need to regulate tourist rooming houses so that a lot of these problems are eliminated.
Yeah, for sure. Greg in Oshkosh, we'll give you a chance. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thank you. I was curious to know if an expert guest can point to any studies about the growth of Eurasian water milfoil and the impact on property values for lake homes.
Yeah, there are. Eurasian water milfoil is, as a lot of your listeners, Larry, probably know, it's a nuisance invasive species that grows in prolific proportion. And it can create mats on the surface that restrict boating. It kind of creates a monoculture in the lake so that the vegetation in the lake is not as diverse. There's actually, I cite in the book one study that was done indicating that in a lake that's infested with Eurasian water milfoil, the property values are harmed. That's just one study. So I think just intuitively, though, if you've ever seen a lake that has excessive weed growth, it's generally going to be less appealing than a lake that has natural normal weed growth. And so there's also a whole range of studies indicating that water clarity or water quality is a huge component of the property of the value of properties and homes around a lake.
So if the lake is not healthy, property values go down. So, lake owners are not lake owners, but lake home owners have, you would think, just if, for no other reason than protecting the value of what they have.
Yeah, I think that's really an important concept. I'm glad you brought that up. When we develop our properties unwisely, we often don't think that we might actually be hurting ourselves. And one of the scenic values, one of the values of Northwood's property, is scenic value, wildlife, and just the vistas that we get looking out on the lake. And when we overdevelop our properties, we erode those qualities, and we can actually harm the value of the property, not just our own property, but all the properties around the lake, and just the whole region is impacted in terms of property value by unwise development.
And John emailed and wonders, and you do discuss this in the book, the kinds of shrubs and plants and so forth that should be along every lakeshore that a homeowner has.
Yeah, ideally you have healthy plant life in the water, and it's good to have wood in the water, fallen trees and branches, because that's good fish habitat. The aquatic plants, now moving up from the water to the upland, the aquatic plants provide oxygen for the water and some buffering against the action of waves on the shoreline. And then as we go up the slope to the property, we should have an understory of plants, as well as shrubs, and then trees. So those three levels of vegetation makes for a healthy shoreline.
And it looks good too.
It does. You don't have to spend, if your shoreline is not as natural right now as it could be, you don't have to spend a whole lot of money on a restoration project, although you can. But one of the things that's recommended by the University of Wisconsin Extension Lakes is what you call no-mow, where you just stop mowing the lawn from, let's say, from the lakeshore to 30, 35, 50 feet inland, and the grass will grow, and there will be a natural seed bank that will allow plants to develop, and pretty soon you'll have a buffer strip that will help keep the water that runs off the property from flowing directly into the lake, and the nutrients will feed the vegetation on land and not in the water.
Yeah. Boathouses, you mentioned boathouses, they can create problems, because they're right on the water, of course.
Well, yeah, by definition, a boathouse takes away the natural shoreline, which, again, is the most richest and natural and biodiverse property around a lake. And it's I know that a lot of people like to have a boathouse with a party deck on top that where they can sit and look at the water and enjoy a meal or a drink, but it does have a significant impact on the natural character of the lake.
You are president of the Oneida County Lakes and Rivers Association. Maybe talk, I can see how you got involved in this, but talk about more about the association and what it does and you know, what other lake associations might follow suit with.
Yeah, there are county lake associations around the state. There's a Vilas County has a similar one. Other counties do as well. And what we try to do is be advocates for protection of the lakes. Advocacy, education is our role. We are not politically, we're not partisan, we're not active in a partisan sense. We work with the county board, the county zoning department, and we try to offer our opinion on, for example, zoning regulations, things that affect the lakes. And then we try to share information with people around the county just in general on how to be good stewards of lakes and lake property.
And it's and can you cite some places where you've been successful?
Yeah, well, I wish we could move the needle more. It's very difficult to make progress. But we published several years ago a booklet called Doing the Right Thing for Our Lakes, and it's a collection of 20 little essays about good practices that lake property owners can follow, and that was real popular. We help support the county in its efforts against invasive species, and we've recently passed a resolution, a template resolution for county individual lake associations to adopt or tailor to their purposes dealing with the impacts of wake boats, wake surfing, wake boarding. Those are some examples of things we've done lately.
I'm wondering about people who don't live on lakes. How might they be involved in this whole effort?
You know, I think that's really an important constituency that doesn't get reached out to or doesn't get involved as much as they might. I haven't been a lake property owner all my life. I was a fisherman, and I visited lots of lakes, and I think individual anglers, boaters, wildlife watchers, whatever, can have a significant amount of impact if they get involved with organizations such as Oneida County Lakes and Rivers, or just get active in their county and township governments on lake issues.
And the DNR obviously plays a role and has worked with a number of associations, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, we have a really good program. The DNR has what's called the Healthy Lakes and Rivers Initiative, where there are five different kinds of lake improvement projects that people can undertake with help from some state grants. There's education around how to apply for these grants. The University of Wisconsin Extension Lakes is real involved in that program. And The DNR also provides grants for controlling invasive species. There's what they call rapid response grants, and there are also when an invasive species is detected, being able to get at it and attack it while it's still in the early stage so that maybe it can be eradicated or at least controlled. And then state funding also helps with Clean Boats, Clean Waters, which is about inspecting boats at boat landings before their launch, so that they're not carrying invasive species into the lake.
Yeah, that's one way where people who don't live on lakes necessarily can have a huge negative impact if they're not following those kinds of practices that you were talking about.
Yeah, that's right. Again, I'll cite Paul Radomski again. He likes to say that you'd have to be living under a rock not to know that if you're a boater, you should inspect your boat before you put it in the water and when you take it out. And so there's been a great deal of education that's been done by university people, county invasive species coordinators, the DNR, lake associations. So a tremendous amount of work has been done, and it's very effective, but still we have some holes in our safety net.
Yeah, for sure. Well, how optimistic are you about the long-term future of our Wisconsin lakes?
Well, I have to be optimistic, because if I wasn't, I would have a hard time getting up in the morning and doing this work. But I think that the reason that people harm the lakes is not that they don't care. I and my colleagues on Oneida County Lakes and Rivers, most of the people I deal with feel that people want to do the right things. They're not malicious. They're not trying to be harmful. They're not reckless. They just don't necessarily know the right things to do. And we find that when you introduce people to some of these concepts, the response is favorable. So it's a lot of good individual one-on-one property owner to property owner communication that can really help the situation.
Well, I think your book provides a real template for our lakes and improving our lakes and how we go about doing it, Ted. The book is kind of just out. How's it done?
I think it's the response has been really great. I can name about a dozen instances where someone has picked up the book and liked it enough that they bought several copies to give to their Lake Association board members, or one gentleman bought 30 copies to hand out at a meeting. Yeah, so that happens a lot. And just on the basis of showing this book to the heads of statewide lake associations in Minnesota and Michigan, I got invited to speak at their conferences. I was just yesterday over in Minnesota talking to the annual meeting of the Minnesota Coalition of Lake Associations. So the book's having an impact, and I'm happy to see it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, of course, it's published by the University of Wisconsin Press. So it should be able to get a copy almost anywhere, I would think.
It's easy to get a hold of. I have a website called thelakeguy.net. Kate Archer Kent from The Morning Show once called me the Lake Guy. So I kind of picked up and ran with that. But I have the website at thelakeguy.net. The books are for sale there, but they're also available in any bookstore and online sources that people are familiar with or directly from UW Press.
Good template and really well written written in a fashion that I think was very appealing to me, and I think it will be to our other readers as well. Ted, thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I look forward to another visit from you. Ted Ralsei, our guest today, freelance writer, book author, advocate for protecting and preserving our inland lakes, and his book is titled Ripple Effects, How We're Loving Our Lakes to Death. It's published by the University of Wisconsin Press. Take a look. I think you're going to be pleased and kind of amazed at some points in what you read from it. Well, coming up, we're going to take a look at what's going on at Milwaukee's Urban Ecology Center. Lots going on there, and you'll find out about it coming up next. I'm Larry Mueller.